This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. Coming up in the show, new music from Robin Guthrie of Cocteau Twins fame. Plus, we'll also hear from musician and videographer Elizabeth Owens. Natasha Fraser Cavassoni was the last person to be hired at Andy Warhol's factory, and she wants to talk about her experiences, including an affair she had at 17 years of age with a certain Michael Philip Jagger. I'll talk to Natasha about her book, After Andy, Adventures in Warhol Land. First, the book is titled Capote's Women, A True Story of Love, Betrayal, and a Swan Song for an Era. The author, oh gosh, a man that's written so many great books that I've enjoyed, Lawrence Lima. Lawrence, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Well, thanks for having me.
And as I said, I've read a number of your books and thoroughly enjoyed them. I like the way that you write. I want to bring that up first of all. It's really, you've got a certain kind of style, a knack for getting readers interested and keeping them interested, and really like that a great deal.
Well, thank you.
So you have a fascination with the rich and famous, and this book really delves in and gives us some juicy, scandalous details. Talk to me about being fascinated by these people.
Well, I'm just not fascinated by the rich. I mean, I've worked in a coal mine, worked in a factory in France. I've covered wars. But I'm fascinated by the rich as well. And I think you could write good books about them. And that's what I've tried to do. But I sure as hell have learned that not to be envious of somebody if they've got that big house in Palm Beach or that penthouse in New York, and if they got the yacht, doesn't mean they're happy, I'll tell you.
Yes, and gosh, you do tell us, you paint some amazingly. When some of the stories are so tragic about the women that you talk about in the book. So let's get into the basics of it. So Truman Capote, I think most people are familiar with the man, his writing, and of course his sort of dilettante lifestyle, particularly towards the end of his life. Truman Capote is a fascinating character no matter what. Lots of bit has been written about him. But then there's a sort of a comparison between how he grew up and the people that he associated with for such a long time, the ladies that he really was fascinated by, and they were fascinated by him.
Well, it's kind of amazing. You think he's just Monroeville, Alabama. That's where he grows up. Is brought up basically by his aunts and relatives and things. His mother was often off by herself, and he shows up in New York and in the early 40s, and he's this 5'2" gay guy, so flamboyantly gay at a time when most part of America is illegal to be gay. But he was he was making a statement about himself that few people dared to make, and he was attracted from earlier, even in high school, to these lives of wealth. And he was attracted to beauty. And he thought, this is where you find beauty. This is where you find elegance. And he wanted to be there. And these women had it probably more than anybody. These seven women, there was nothing like them in America. In the whole world, there was nothing like the seven women.
Yes, and the stories that you tell about the women, in some respects, these would be shocking stories, even told today. There's some aspects of their lives there. And I was going to say love lives, but they're not really love lives. They're more like they're conquests, aren't they?
Exactly, exactly.
It's a kind of business deal that most of them make with themselves in some respects, with the men that they associate with. I'm not sure that I can pick out one that's more sort of shocking than the other. They all seem to have sort of shock value to their stories.
Well, one of these women, probably the smartest, is Gloria Guinness. She was Mexican American, and she ended up she's married several times. She had an affair in World War II in Berlin with the Nazi spy chief, and she ends up married to this loyal Guinness of the Guinness family, in Irish family, and he was a member of Parliament. And she wrote a column for Harper's Bazaar, and in 1 month, this is her theory of how the world goes on, that beautiful women, beautiful, elegant women, not just when they're 20 years old, but maintain the beauty of their life, the men aspire to have have one of these women. And so they work very hard. And society advances because men work so hard so they can have one of these beautiful women. That's her theory of how society advances. Well, you know, it wasn't about love. It was about finding the man that had the wealth and position that you need. And for the man, he wants one of these women on his arm. He wants to show off to other powerful men that this is what he has.
You go into great detail about each woman. You just mentioned Gloria Guinness, and I'm not going to tell you who my favorite is, if I have to pick a favorite because of her story. But do you, Lawrence Lima, do you have a favorite out of the swans?
A favorite? I guess I don't. I looked at each one in different ways. And I mean, I didn't. CZ Guest, I kind of a very snob. I don't like snobs. So I probably liked her the least because I don't know. I just don't like that.
The men in the swans' lives, they accepted Truman because he was gay and they didn't consider him a threat.
Right.
But the men themselves, Bill Paley, for instance, seemed to me like not a particularly nice man.
Oh, no way was he a nice man. He was in some ways a despicable man. But he had the money and the power, and you know, that was it.
Yes.
He treated his wife terribly. Imagine what her life was like. She when she was 17, was an automobile accident. She had her face had plastic surgery. She lost her teeth. So she slept in a different bedroom than him. She got up in the morning. She put in her teeth. She put in her elaborate makeup even before her husband saw her. So her whole life was this elaborate makeup. I mean, anorexia was sort of the occupational disease of this woman. How could they stay so thin all their lives? There's a picture in the book of Gloria Guinness when she's got to be 60 years old. You look at it, she looks 20 years old. She's just incredible the way she looked.
Yes, yeah. The stories that you tell, I'm wondering about the research that you did, Lawrence. You had to sort of dive in and talk to a lot of people. How did you go about that, getting the intimate details that you did?
Well, it was tough because I did it during the pandemic, okay? So the New York Public Library, which had Truman's papers, I couldn't go in there. I couldn't at the Library of Congress, that was closed too, so I couldn't get Pamela Harriman's papers. And I wanted to go to Italy for Marella Agnelli to go to talk to Turan and talk to her friends and her husband, you know, the late head of Fiat. I couldn't do that. So I was quite limited in what I could do. But I found every scrap I could find to put it together and to create a portraits that were truthful and fascinating.
And the photographs, you must have searched through lots and lots of photographs for the book. And you've got some selected ones in here. But what made you select the ones that you selected? Because they are very good.
Well, because what are these women?
Yeah.
What do they want? It's this image that they project to the world. So Truman said that these women created their own art form. Okay.
Yes.
Their presentation was an art form, that they would spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on clothes. They were obsessed with this. So when they went to the Colony or some really, you know, first class restaurant, everybody would turn and look at them.
Yes.
That was their creation.
You know, Lawrence, as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking about the comparisons between the people that are famous today for being famous. And I don't want to get into the names and all the rest of it, but I just have the feeling, and I'd like to hear from you, whether the swans that Capote was raving on about and wrote about and flirted around with, there is no comparison really today of the people that are famous for being famous. Don't really compare to those people, do they, to the swans?
No, they won't. But here's one difference is the contemporary celebrity monetizes her life, right?
Yes.
She's going to sell her clothing image or her makeup, whatever it is. I mean, William Paley was a brilliant businessman. I mean, if he were in this era, he would be merchandising Babe Paley. There'd be Babe Paley clothes, Babe Paley necklaces, whatever.
The I can remember the name. I can't think of the
Agnelli,
name.
Agnelli? Yeah.
Agnelli, yes. Now, there's a fascinating story, just picking on that one, because he when they get married, he's on crutches or he's on sticks because he's broken his legs in a terrible car accident. Yet he's just like acting like everything's perfectly okay and just smug as all can be. That's fascinating.
Yeah, that's the way he was. And you talk about a womanizer, a playboy. This guy was unbelievable. He spent half his life. He was a rich guy, a rich heir. And so he didn't want to work at Fiat until he was in his mid-40s. He just was a constant stream of women and drugs. I mean, he was incredible. And it was so, a lot of these people, they're kind of timid because they're afraid they're going to die. They got so much money, they want to take any chances. This guy would jump out of a helicopter into the Mediterranean. That was his way of showing up.
As you're collating the information, was there a point where you said, there's only so far I can go? Or did you curtail yourself at any point? Were there anything that was so risque or so sort of, I don't know, controversial that you said, maybe I just should back off?
I probably would be smarter if I did that, but I don't do that. Whatever is there, I'm going to put it in, the good and the bad. I mean, I don't care what it is. As long as I think it's the truth, I'm going to put it in there.
What do you think that Truman Capote would think of Lawrence Lima's Capote's Women?
I think he'd respect me for doing it because it stays true to him. It stays too true to these women. And, you know, it's obviously I have great affection for him.
Yes.
Despite all his weaknesses, I admire him. And I want him to be remembered. You know, Gerald Clark wrote this wonderful biography, the definitive biography. And
yes.
Clark knew him for the last 10 years of his life. So Clark did. If I had been in the same situation, I would have done the same thing. But a disproportionate part of that book are those last years when Clark knew him. So we think about the dissipation and the drugs. I don't think Truman should be remembered for that. I think he should be remembered for his gifts and for his contribution and for his artistic genius.
And he was a genius,
yes.
Lawrence. That's the thing that comes across in your book. From the early days in Alabama, the spark shines through and all the way through. And I totally agree with you about the last years of his life. And I just got the feeling, and like you, the more I read of your book, and I'd already read the biography, and I'd already read other books about Capote, but I got the feeling that you, as you just said, you really admired Capote. And the last years of his life seemed to me to be, yes, they were tragic, but on another sense, they were the result of who he was, because he was a genius, because he was such a smart writer, because he was so intelligent about things. And I don't know that he actually was deliberately sort of wasting his life. I don't think that was happening at all. What's your take on that?
Well, look, a man, to be a gay man in America at that time, for starters, to be a genius as an author, to have this world where you know, look, an author has to be observant, okay? I mean, I'm pretty observant saying things, but nothing like this guy. Everywhere he was, he'd be talking to you, and he'd be looking at the books in the back. He'd be thinking, he'd be seeing all these things that nobody else would see, and that's what he did. It was just kind of painful to be that sensitive in so many ways, and that's what it is. And to try to change that and try to put that down in your books, it was not easy. And in some ways, he did very well. He could have made a living as a writer of nonfiction. He wrote The Muses Are Heard in the New Yorker magazine about this trip to Russia from the cast of Porgy and Bess. Just a brilliant piece of nonfiction. And again, he could have done that. He was so talented in so many ways. But it's just painful to be that talented. And it's painful when a celebrity takes over your life. And you don't know if people like you. Do they like me, or did it become a celebrity? And wherever I go, I have to be entertaining.
Yes.
Okay, wherever I go, I have to be amusing, no matter how I feel.
Do you think there were people in his life at a certain point, or maybe many points, but I'm just thinking, for instance, like Cecil Beaton, who had a sort of penchant for being deliberately over the top and making sort of making trouble and just being... Did people like Beaton, I'm just picking on that name.
Yeah, he's a good example.
Well, just sort of influencing him in just being sort of a little bit... more over the top than he needed to be.
Yeah, I think it's probably true. That's the way it was. And Beaton was kind of nasty about him too.
Yes, yes. Because you said you admired him, right? We agree on that. But was there parts of him that, as a writer, you wished that he'd have been maybe put more effort in or worked harder?
No, whatever he wrote. I mean, he would go over a sentence for endless time. And if you look at those pages that he wrote, to me, it's just perfection. So many of these things, okay? And I know how hard it is. I know how many times I would have to rewrite. But it's not his writing. It was just having the discipline. Now, I was down in Key West a couple of months ago doing a thing. It's the Matt Asher show that's going to be an hour-long interview with me on PBS in December. And we went to the Hemingway Museum, which is what an awesome it was for me to go up and see where he writes and stuff up to his office. And realizing that no matter how many drinks he had the night before, what he did, he was up early in the morning to write his 600 to 800 words. And in this thing, they have a quote from Hemingway. He says, you know, a writer should write. I shouldn't be talking to you. I should be back writing. And that's a writer's life. And it's a life of solitude. I mean, it's not,
yes,
you know, it's a tough, psychologically, it's a very tough life to spend most of your time in a room by yourself.
And of course, one other thing that we have to remember is that when Capote was writing, he didn't have the benefit of having a computer in front of him. He wasn't tapping away and then could, you know, save a paragraph here and save a paragraph there. It was all by hand, correctly?
He wrote notebooks.
Your notebooks, right, exactly. Going to throw a couple of names out to you. Onassis.
Well, Onassis is important because Lee Radziwill had an affair with him. And after the death of Patrick Kennedy, the Kennedy baby in the summer of 1963, Lee Radziwill invited his sister to kind of get over that, to come on Onassis's yacht. And Onassis was taken by Jackie and sort of dismissed Lee. And, you know, after the death of Bobby Kennedy, Jackie marries Onassis, and Lee was outraged at that. He felt that Jackie had stolen Onassis from her.
And you say in your book, and I'm not sure I'm quoting you directly, but you say Onassis was animalistic and uneducated.
That's pretty close.
Yeah, yes. You paint a picture of a man that is absolutely horrible. I mean, a lot of the men that you paint in the book, Lawrence, are just disgusting men. But Onassis just comes across as brutish and just absolutely disgusting. Well, you told this.
Thank God he's dead. I don't have to worry about a libel suit, right?
Yes, yes. I was wondering about that. If you ever thought about that, if these people were alive. You told this story about how he gives Jackie this amazing necklace, this over-the-top necklace. And then because he's not interested in Lee anymore, he just gives her this little tiny bangle that... like a child's toy.
Exactly.
One of the characters is Winston Churchill's son, who's just a bore, just a horrible remnant. Yeah, just a remnant from an age that doesn't exist anymore.
I'm afraid nobody's going to buy my book listening to this.
No,
it all sounds so dreadful.
No, the fact of the matter is, it's so fascinating because page after page, you open up the door, you like the Pandora's box of all these secrets and stories about these women and their lives are just horrible from morning till night. So Truman Capote, as you're writing the book and you're talking about the women, but you're also talking about his interaction with the women, I'm wondering whether you wondered about how much Truman was not just secretly, but just he's dealing with Babe, he's dealing with Gloria, whoever he's dealing with at the time, and whether he's just, I don't know, sucking it up, or he's just like smiling sweetly as he could, but at the same time, he's just thinking, oh my God, you're just horrible, or your husband's horrible. How much did he ever, do you think, just cover up his real feelings?
Listen, he would go, there was a manicurist that dealt with all of these women, and she hated Truman because she knew that when Truman would come around and he would he would say these terrible things about the woman he wasn't with, Swan that he wasn't with. To her, it was all lovey-dovey. Do the others know he'd say these terrible things? It was the ultimate gossip in that way. I don't think he I don't think he had a true friend in the world. I think it was just him, total isolation by himself. Is why did he like heterosexual men? That's what he liked to get them to change and be gay. Okay, but and these are real heterosexual men. His first lover was married. He was an actor. He played one of the cowboys in Oklahoma. His wife was a star, and he said if I'd stayed married to my wife, I never would have had a gay affair. But he becomes Truman's lifelong lover. He had two other lovers that later on that both were married men and had children. But what was the excitement of that? Maybe I don't know. It's kind of bizarre.
I don't know that I can give you an answer to that. I don't know. But I, as I'm reading your book, I went back to an interview that I remember Truman did, I think in the 70s, maybe the late 70s. It could have been in the early 80s with the TV producer. Yes. That famous interview that with Sussman.
Susskind.
You've seen that interview many times, I'm sure.
Yes.
Truman in that interview is very outspoken. He's almost abrasive about it. I mean, he's very kind of mean in some respects in that interview. And it reminded me of some of the, just, I was comparing it to how he was in the book and how, and just the way he spoke about the women behind their backs. Truman was a man who, if he hadn't been, I guess being gay was the whole point, wasn't it? If he hadn't have been gay, he wouldn't have had the fascination with the women, or would he? Could that have happened?
You know, it's funny you say that because I'm not gay, and I'm running with this gay man. And first of all, I couldn't use the word queer because my generation. That to me was something you would never use. And I'd write a page, you should write the word queer here. Somehow I thought I'd be, I can't do that. It's like, it's not a nice word. The other thing is, I couldn't use the word bitchy because I didn't want to have stereotypes about gays. But
right.
Okay. But that there was an aspect, you know, called bitchiness or just ironic insight into these people. But he certainly had that.
Yes. The reaction to the book from, it's just coming out right now, from the estates or from the relatives or family and friends of some of the Swans, has there been any feedback?
No, but the book itself has gotten maybe the best reviews of my life, or pretty darn close to it. Not a negative word, so fingers crossed, probably tomorrow there'll be some savage reviews.
Yes,
so far.
What I like about the book is the way that it's put together. The way, as I started off by saying, you have a fascinating way of writing about a fascinating topic, and you're not judgmental in the book. We're talking about the different characters now, but you give us a sort of a well-rounded, a 3D approach to who you're talking about. And that I really appreciated about the book.
Oh, thank you.
A True Story of Love, Betrayal, and a Swan Song for an Era. How true that is. Capote's Women, my guest, Lawrence Lima. Lawrence, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
That was great. You were terrific.
Thank you so much, Lawrence. Bye-bye now. You need to know the Life Elsewhere podcast is now available at Anchor FM. Pop on over and let us know what you think. Coming up, Natasha Fraser Cavasoni takes us behind the scenes into Warhol land. But first, new music from Robin Guthrie of Cocteau Twins fame. Here then is In Love and At War from Robin Guthrie. Thank you. It's been 39 years since the Cocteau Twins' debut release, Garlands. Now Mockingbird Love, the EP, is the first new release from Robin Guthrie since Another Flower, the album with the late Harold Budd, released just days before Budd's passing in December 2020. We heard In Love and At War from Robin Guthrie's EP, Mockingbird Love, and Robin says, of late, I've been very focused on my instrumental music, which is increasingly an intense endeavor, all the more so as I don't really share it with anyone. So here I am, finally with some words about my next release, Mockingbird Love, a four-track EP. Now, it's a small collection of music that I've felt comfortable to release for a while. This is my October, says Robin. Thoughtful words. Next, music that came to my attention by the always astute Nancy Curls of Grimblekin Records. It's Elizabeth Owens with Once in a While. More info on the other side. Thank you. From their LP Knock Knock, we heard Once in a While by Elizabeth Owens, who says they are a poet and a producer, constantly coming of age. Elizabeth Owens is out of Richmond, Virginia, and has made videos to accompany each track on their album, and I do recommend that you investigate their work. Next, Natasha Fraser Cavassoni is going to talk to me about her book, After Andy, Adventures in Warhol Land, right after this.
To the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
The world of Andy Warhol is the subject of a book by Natasha Fraser Cavassoni. Here's Mr. Bowie to get us prepared.
A cement fix, be a standing cinema. Dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are. Put the people in my brain, two new pens to have a go. I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Okay, Natasha, you're on the line with Norman.
Hey, Natasha, how are you?
Good. good. How nice to hear an English accent.
Yes, we've got lots to talk about here, so I'm going to get it underway. I'm going to do a little introduction, and then we'll go from there, if that's okay with you.
Sounds fantastic.
Okay, stand by. The book is called After Andy, Adventures in Warhol Land, and the author is Natasha Fraser Cavassoni. Natasha, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you, Norman.
When I finally write my biography, I hope I have an editor like you had. And on that note, I want to go to the back of your book, if you don't mind, and that is, under acknowledgements, you say that Sarah, your editor, was tirelessly encouraging and fun. I always look forward to our calls. There were a few instances of Natasha. I'm sure that that was a very important moment for you, but it simply doesn't work here. I love that, because I'm just wondering, Natasha, having thoroughly enjoyed your book, I wonder about how much you left out and what you put in. And then I found that at the end of the book, and I thought that was wonderful that you put that in. Talk to me about leaving stuff out of the book.
With someone like After Andy, Norman, I mean, sorry, someone like Andy Warhol, you have to be so specific to keep the flow, don't you?
Yes.
I mean, everyone has a Warhol story or anecdote. And I was very keen that it really be about, if you want, the thread or fil de conducteur in French. And he had to be the thread.
Yes.
So it had to be really important that the reader would go along with it. And not suddenly think, oh, nice anecdote, but blocks the flow.
Yes. Yes. Now, I've got to ask you about the title. Let's start there, because the title is After Andy.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that really is a deliberate play on words, because people were after Andy, literally. They were after Andy. And as you point out in your book, the value of Warhol's work now is extraordinary compared to when he was alive. So after Andy works in that sense as well. I'm wondering about that. Was that deliberate on your part?
I'm afraid to say you're the first person who has pointed this out. It takes a Brit living in Florida, in Tampa, Florida, to point this out. No, seriously. But it was always going to be my title,
yes.
After Andy. I liked it, and it really was After Andy. I mean, I arrived, although I met him a few days before he died. I mean, I met him originally when I was 16.
Yes.
You know, the whole idea of working for him, we met on Thursday, and the poor man was dead on Sunday.
Yes.
And instead of being prepared for the cameras, Norman, I was fielding calls about his death.
Oh, gosh. Yes. You sum that up so well. You paint that picture of the funeral, and it's a lovely beginning to the book. And I've got to tell everybody, it really is a terrific read. It's called After Andy, Adventures in Warhol Land. My guest, Natasha Fraser Cavassoni. Now, you offer many juicy insights, times and places and people. Did anyone say to you when you were telling them that you were writing this and you were going to different people for interviews, when you were talking to Fred Hughes, when you were talking to all the different people that you went to, did anyone say to you, oh, Natasha, you mustn't say that?
No. I have to say people were pretty, I guess I chose people. You know, again, with a book like this, Norman, you have to be really careful who you had to be very specific what you wanted from everyone.
Yes.
And I was very lucky because I spoke to people like Larry Gagosian and other, you know, art world powers.
Right.
And I knew what I wanted from them. You know, it was all about the worth of Warhol. I spoke to Bob Colicello, who was incredibly generous. And I have to say, I'd like to emphasize that his book, Holy Terror, His Life with Warhol, is to me the best biography of Warhol.
Yes.
My book is a memoir using Andy's a thread. But, you know, so no one said, oh, don't say that. I have to say people were very kind. And also, fortunately, I kept diaries.
Yes.
Even from when I was really young. And so that, you know, they came in extremely handy. And my mother, the best-selling historian,
yes,
Antonia Fraser, has the best photo albums, and they were another fantastic source. Her photo albums are staggering because she writes, you know,
yes,
a lot of funny things. The photos are great, and she keeps things like baby hair. You know?
I love that. Yeah. You know, it's interesting you mentioned about your diaries, because I wrote down here a question that I had to ask you, and that is that you refer to your diaries quite a lot, and I wanted to ask you about how deep your diaries went.
They went, so, you know, there was a lot of, I was young, a certain amount of angst. I wanted to keep this very up.
Yeah.
My idea was to make it up. It was a really up time, Norman. And I don't like, I'm kind of bored of those memoirs that accuse. I wanted, you know, the French say j'accuse because I live in France.
Yes.
And I wanted this to be j'avoue, I admit, I was there, I did that, I slept with him, da 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 da.
Yes.
I wanted it to be, if I was going to do this, Norman, I had to be honest. But I didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings. That's
well, you,
not my...
Yes, and you are honest in the book, and we're going to get to that in a moment, and you know what we're going to talk about, of course.
Never.
But as you're going through the... I think we should let everybody know that your relationship with Andy, as you say, started just before he dies. So you're talking about Andy Warhol in the latter part of his life, literally.
Well,
and
I
so,
met him, though... Sorry to
yes.
interrupt, but I met him in 1980 when I was 16.
Right.
So I knew him for those 7 years. And I think what's interesting about this book is I really focus on that last decade.
Yes.
And his years in Europe and this strange phenomenon called the English muffins, who were well-born women who worked for him.
Yes. Yes. I love that you put that in, because I think a lot of people in America might not exactly understand what that sort of really is referring to. But I think you sum it up so well. Like you do a lot of things in your book, you go, your pace of your book is really terrific, because you move from one place to another and you throw in names. For those of us that know the names, it's terrific. And for people that don't, I think it'd be really good for them to have Wikipedia standing by so they can do a little sort of name checking, if you like, a little train spotting, if you like, you know. There's a couple of things I just want to... this is in a chapter that we sort of touched on it just a couple of moments ago about sleeping with people, because I do want to talk about sex. It's one of my favorite subjects, and I think it comes up in your book quite a bit. So you have a relationship with a certain Michael Philip Jagger.
Yes.
You're extremely young at the time. Not everybody's very approving, but some people, and I love this bit, and I'm going to read it. You go to see a show, and all the Rolling Stones are there. And Shirley Watts, the retiring Shirley Watts, who never gets in the press at all, she kidnaps you, you say, with a lecture on not talking to the newspapers. It's never a good idea, dear, she says. And it's going to haunt you for the rest of your life, dear. I love that. I can imagine Shirley saying that to you. It's just terrific stuff. Talk to me about that time, about that whole, because it must have been, because you, what, were you 16 at the time? You were still in school.
I was still in school, but I was 17.
17.
I was 16 when I met Warhol.
Yeah.
And what was funny, at that first lunch where I met him, there was someone called Harry Bailey who was in the art world.
Yes.
And he said, you should meet Mick Jagger. And I looked at him, and for me, he was sort of old man. He was
yes.
sort of, you know, he was 36 years old then.
Right.
He said, no, he's really funny. And then what happens, I then meet Mick that summer. It's strange. It's strange how life turns out. I'd like to say that I would never write, I think... Mick Jagger, I mean, remain incredibly fond of him, and he was really, really kind to me. And Mick is an amazing, he has this extraordinary childlike energy.
Yes.
And motivated by curiosity. For me, the great performer, I mean, the great rock and roll performer, and that's not even going into his music.
Right.
And he's kept standing. And something I talk about in this book, you know, there's a quote of Warhol's where he says, I've got to keep the lights on. And what I've really wanted to emphasize in this book, yes, there were lots of bold names and parties and X, Y, and Z, but, you know, the people I focus on Warhol, my stepfather Harold Pinter, my mother Antonia Fraser, Mick Jagger, Karl Lagerfeld at Chanel, Malcolm McLaren. You know, these are all people who kept the lights on. They were all working.
Yes.
And I think that's very, I wanted to push that because it's all very well to get in the headlines, but if you want to remain relevant, you've got to keep at it. It's not hard keeping fame, you know.
Right.
You've got to work.
What was a surprise for you when you were putting the book together, as you were talking to different people, you're going through your diaries, was there something that just you went, oh, gosh, I'd forgotten about that, and it really surprised you?
I was surprised by how self-effacing Warhol was. You know, you meet these big artists with their huge egos, and all they want to do is show you their great paintings. And Warhol kept his own work in the closet. I thought that was amazing.
You know, when you talk about him at the beginning, at the beginning of the book, and you say that you were shocked that he was wearing a wig, and you hadn't realized that.
I really had no idea that it was a wig, because I was brought up with very, very eccentric people.
Yes.
I mean, as you know, my grandfather is Lord Lomford.
Right.
Nicknamed Lord Porn.
Lord Porn, yes, yes.
You know, when introduced to the Queen at one point, his trousers almost fell down because they're held up by string. So I was introduced, when people go on about, that's what surprised me. A lot of people say, oh, you know, Andy's appearance was so weird. Well, his appearance wasn't weird if you were brought up in the 60s and 70s
right.
in England.
Yes, yes, yes. What made you write the book, Natasha?
I was inspired. I went to Chicago and I went to that amazing museum they had, and I saw a Mao, 15-foot Mao, done by him in 1973. And suddenly it was like a sort of blast. It was sort of, I was suddenly reminded of all my memories of Warhol, how I was the last person to be employed there when he was alive, how I met him, how he tried to push on, you know, this Armani model. It was extraordinary.
Yes.
It all came back in that. It was just, I was sort of paralyzed on the spot.
You know, you talk in great depth about the 80s and the 90s and the wonderful places that you went to and the people that you met. I have a sneaking suspicion that that period of time, I'm just a little bit older than you, so I experienced the latter part of the 60s and the 70s. But I have a sneaking suspicion that we're not going to see the likes of those days again. What do you think about that?
Well, every era is different, isn't it? It was quite interesting because I spoke to Bret Easton Ellis, who loves the book and has written about it on Twitter.
Oh, and I love that description of going to his flat, by the way. I love that. It's terrific stuff.
But Bret said it was almost like the jazz. He said, reading your book, I'm reminded of the fact how different the 80s were.
Yes.
It was like the jazz age. But you know, it's strange, Norman. I think there's a change going on.
Mm.
I feel that something is about to give. I personally feel a change with New York. I don't know. I think we've kind of reached the point with perfection. People, I think we're on for a change.
I think you're right. You know, that's so funny you say that. I totally agree. We could go off on a tangent here talking about that, but I think you're absolutely right. Yes.
I think that people have been let down by the government, whether it's our country or whatever. And I think there's a change. There's a sense now of how important it is to be individual.
Before we go, because the time is wrapping up here, I have a never-ending stack of books by the side of my bed. I read all the time. I get sent lots of books. But there is one book that I go back to often, and I'd just like to get your input on that. The book is called Must You Go? My Life with Harold Pinter, written by your mother. I love that book. Can you just...
Oh.
Yeah. I just want, as I've got you here, just tell me about that book, because you must have some thoughts about it.
I love that book. I thought it was very important for her that she write it. And I think it's incredibly moving about Harold. I met Harold when I was I met Harold Pinter when I was 11 years old.
Yeah.
And he changed my life. I felt like I had two fathers in one way.
Yes.
You know, I adored my father, the politician.
Of course, yeah.
But Harold, really, I loved his world.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, before Harold, we always ate at this restaurant called Paradiso Inferno. Just to give you an idea, the woman, every time we arrived, it was empty. And the woman ran out of the kitchen and she'd go, "Children, your mother is the most beautiful woman in the world." And I think we went there because of that. And
yes.
It really stank.
Yes.
Well, Harold, that wasn't happening with Harold. We ate at Mr. Chow, these fantastic restaurants. You know, it was thanks to him I met all these film stars.
Right.
It was really a different existence. And he, Norman, because he so loved the theatre and he loved actors and he wrote for actors, he was the first to teach me about the power and the importance of performance.
Yes. Yes.
You know, he really loved acting. You know, actors love doing Harold's plays, you know, because having been an actor, he wrote, he understood what it was like to write for actors. But he really taught me about performance, Harold, and he really was an incredible character, personality.
I think some of his influence comes across in your book, Natasha. Your book is a terrific read. The book is called After Andy, subtitle Adventures in Warhol Land. We have been talking to Natasha Fraser Cavassoni. Natasha, it's been an absolute delight talking to you. Really enjoyed it.
Mutual. I mean, it's been wonderful, Norman.
Thank you so very much, Natasha.
Merci.
Thanks, Natasha. I know you've got a run. You've got a live one, I think, coming up. So thank you so very much indeed. Bye-bye now.
It was a real pleasure, Norman.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
You know, I have the inclination that Natasha would be excellent fun as a dinner companion. I've got some wonderful guests lined up. I don't want you to miss them. So make sure you go to lifeelsewhere.co to get the updates. And while you're there, do check out Life Elsewhere Music. You can hear all the volumes at your leisure. And also remember that Life Elsewhere is available on iTunes. Till next time, I'm Norman B. And I do hope you know who you are. Be good. Be well. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Vann, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.